good.
All right, welcome listeners. It's your lazy ass host back. It is Max and Joe. It is the long awaited, I promise it was worth it, the first of the money laundering episodes. I went through a couple of textbooks, about 1,000 pages worth of different stuff to put this all together. Because we've said in earlier episodes, as we were setting this up, we kind of just came to the realization that we need to explain money laundering as a whole before we can kind of really dive into these, because it you know, and as I have found out on this journey, money laundering is not what we think it is, and it isn't, but for the most part it is not what we think it is. And so when we start to dive into these stories without kind of understanding the impacts of these certain issues, and you know, for example, trade, you know, based money laundering, when we talk about how pervasive that is, it's, you know, it'll make the stories, you know, when we talk about like cartels in Mexico and things like that, you know, we talk about Hotel Escondido, and the cartel that owns that, you know, it'll make a lot more sense how the money flows. And once you see how the money flows, you kind of get an understanding for the volume of this. So it's a little bit of a long intro. And it is a nice night. We got the Nuggets playing in game something. You guys can tell how sports inclined I am. I started sports betting this year, Joe. I don't know if I told you that yet, but it's been a wild ride. You doing that?
No, dude, that's just a little too. I'm not against it. The problem is I'm the type of guy who would like intend to do $25 and end up doing like $25,000 and just being that hole ever deeper.
Well, I can tell you that like it is a lot easier to put money in than out, because it's kind of funny. I started this because I was in between paychecks, and I had done Grubhub in the past and things like that, and I just didn't want to do that again. And so a couple of the degenerates that I consult with, I was talking to them and they were like, well, you know, we do stuff on DraftKings, and you know, if you put $25 in, you'll get you'll get a free $25 bet. And so I let them set it up, and then I let them, you know, tell me what to bet on. And so I kind of set up a fun account, and then I started like doing a little bit of research, and I found all these promos that these things were doing. And so I was like, okay, well, I need like $600 to get through or whatever. And so I found like four different sports books that were doing like bet $10, get $200, you know, if somebody makes a shot or whatever. And so I did a bunch of those and then won them. And then I waited until there was like really opportune games, which unfortunately as a Denver fan was generally like against our own team. It's like the game tonight, I did one of those. And so to extract my $200, I had to bet against I'd love to lie and say beloved Nuggets, but I don't really watch basketball. So it's been a kind of an interesting hedge to see, the average deposit seems to be about $20, and so far I've been able to extract all my winnings out. Now that said, I do keep like a fun money account on DraftKings, because I found that I like I don't know what I'm doing, but I like the live bets on some of the stuff, so the wild odds that I can throw $5 on and win 40, because that's just crazy to me. So that part's been fun. So, but I think I've got like two more promos left, and then I got to get out because I've used all the like first time freebies. But yeah, it was an interesting hedge. So when we're talking about money laundering, I thought that would be an appropriate way to do that, because I can tell you that I do a lot of math to try to hedge that $50 fun money account. And I keep it about even. My P&L is pretty much exactly zero with it, which is a wild ride. So, you know, these guys who are out there making money, guys and girls making money on this or losing money, it's crazy, you know, especially when you start seeing like the four or five, digit deposit bonuses. So, you know, with that, we'll start moving into the episode we were talking about. So a lot of this comes from the same book, and I'll put that up. It was written by a former law enforcement official, which I think is a good, not, I don't want to say bad thing, but, you know, I noticed this going through college when I would read sort of economic textbook crime stuff that was a little bit similar, written by law enforcement guys. And there's a very interesting kind of line that they can't really seem to think through. And the author touches on this in terms of, you know, but, you know, I hate to say the trope of thinking like a criminal, but that is a lot of the issue. And this is, and so, you know, when I distill down what is thinking like a criminal, I think that really comes down to market knowledge. And so it's, I think there's a very interesting intersection of, you know, how do you have to train to be a, you know, a law enforcement officer, say an IRS agent, versus understanding the markets you are enforcing, you know, and both of those take many, many years to understand. You know, I can tell you, you know, you can tell, you know, you can tell us from hedge funds, we'll talk about that as well. But I can tell you, you know, from cannabis, you know, and what you would think is a golden paradise, you know, a green triangle of money. There's a lot of cost associated with it. There's a lot of overhead. There's a lot of headache. There's a lot of compliance. There's a lot of legal. There's a lot, you know, anything that makes a lot of money. And I'm sure you can attest to this, Joe, accessory businesses find a really good way to lobby their need in, such as lawyers. So you can, like, you know, would you say it's fair if you want to start like a family, you know, a family office, venture capital, hedge fund, you need at least, you know, $500,000 for legal just to get going. Do you think that's a fair estimate? I caught him right in the middle of moving.
Yeah. I mean, probably more than that. Yeah, I would put it at $1 million, actually.
And it's incredible when you break down a number like that, because it really is. Would you pay $1 million to not go to jail? It's a very interesting question that is really at the heart of money laundering. And, you know, and so to wrap it back to my original point of why it's not necessarily good or bad that law enforcement writes these books, but that there's this interesting tint that I think a lot of them don't understand the market thoroughly in terms of crime. You know, and I'm just saying that as my own personal anecdotal evidence, as somebody who is in, you know, federally a black market, you know, locally a green market. But it's the access of criminality is still there. There is absolutely people, and, you know, not as much now. There's pretty good enforcement now, but back in those days, there was, you know, there's a lot of Wild West stuff, and, you know, people making money how they shouldn't. You see, you know, busts in California, dispensaries owned by cartels. And so, you know, I'm not insulated from that totally out, you know, out here in Colorado in our market. So it's interesting to see, and I can understand a lot of why this happens, and it's a lot more of a business than it is a crime. And that was the piece that I think that the law enforcement, at least in the stuff that I read written by law enforcement, that was a really hard part for them to understand, is, you know, kind of understanding this is a business for these guys in terms of, like, they're buying pencils, and you know, we think of money laundering and we think of a bunch of guys, you know, with bags of cash, but it's, you know, it's guys in an office, and you're buying supplies, and you're paying for electric and legal and all of this stuff. And it's really is a business. And so we'll go into this interesting intersection, but yeah, so that's kind of my two cents. Joe, as somebody who is in the financial services, you know, who is directly responsible for compliance against this, what do you guys, what's kind of your stance, you know, not necessarily politically if you want to go, you know, but whatever, you know, how do you interact with it on a daily basis?
Yeah, so for the right or wrong reasons, the free market has pretty much made money laundering through any sort of fund, at least in the U.S., in Asia, that, or Russia, you know, there, or some other place, you know, you may find some loopholes. But even, you know, the U.S., the Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, the industry is so self-regulated. And then on top of that, it's got additional layers of regulation from the various entities that enforce that the only way I could see it happening in a modern times is through crypto. as far as the finance industry in and of itself. Now, there's plenty of ways to get around that if you're willing to not use, you know, a hedge fund or a venture capital fund or a family office. Like, the, you know, it's almost like the ends to the mean are infinite. But as far as people doing it through hedge funds, I know for a while there was a movie out in England, and the quote was, "Oh, I'm the next baddest thing after a gangster. I'm a banker." No, no, you're not. Well, actually, I'll rephrase that. No, you're not. If you're a hedge fund manager, if you're a banker at HSBC, not to call out HSBC. Anyone listening who works there, we love you. But, you know, if you're HSBC or Deutsche Bank, you know, some things are going to get through the cracks, whether that's willful ignorance or some other mechanism. But if you're a hedge fund, like, no, it's impossible. Like, the you can do it through banks and you can do it through crypto, but the idea that you can do it through funds anymore nowadays is out the window.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring up those points, because we're going to talk about it, because it's anymore. And as somebody who has, you know, bought a lot of stupid shit coin things, it was a very interesting dive into how the exchanges make money. We're going to go into all this, but I think what we're going to end up finding is, and that the way that money laundering works is it's always evolving, and it is, you touched on it, it is getting through before the loophole closes. Because once the regulation is there, it's there forever. And so we're going to talk about all of that. So that was I think that's a good segue into, so somebody who does this professionally, you know, does legal, you know, makes money for his clients as a service. And, you know, he's telling you that, you know, you cannot just take a bag of cash to the Cayman Islands and have it come back clean, like the movies would have you talk about. So what is the issue with money laundering then, if it's not easy? So let's talk about how much money is laundered. So when we talk about money laundering, we're going to kind of use, it's not necessarily the definition I would use, but I think it's just kind of a good starting point, and I'll let everybody in their own right kind of nail down what they believe is their own personal definition, because it's a global, it's a global network of laws and things like that. So there is no just one right answer to what is money laundering. So just for our purposes right now, we're going to say it is using the proceeds of any illegal activity, you know, for anything, right? So if you, and that doesn't necessarily just mean drugs or whatever, if you make income and you don't report it to the government and you use that to buy a jet ski, we would consider that money laundering. Things like that. So essentially unreported income that, you know, is also made from an illicit stream. So how much of that is really a problem? So the International Monetary Fund estimates that 2 to 5% of global GDP is laundered money. And that's as late as 2018. So in 2018, world GDP was $85 trillion, which means that we account for about, money laundering would account for about a $4 trillion industry. So of that $4 trillion, 2.4 of that, so $2.4 trillion is laundered through banks, and $1.6 is laundered through unconventional money markets. Tax havens in 2010 were estimated to house $21 to $32 trillion in over 80 tax havens. The lower 139 lower income and middle income countries were found to have $7.3 to $9.3 trillion in unrecorded offshore wealth. And then while that was happening, it was like 95% of them or something were insolvent or borrowing money at the time. So what is kind of the cost to all this? So we think that the developing nations lose about $1 trillion in illicit outflows just through trade-based money laundering. So not even making anything illegal, but not necessarily making anything illegal. It could just be things like fake invoicing and such like that. Large countries such as India and Mexico are estimated to have 30 to 50% of their GDP in informal economies. So, and you know, I skipped a little bit, but let me pull up. So when we were talking about that, it's a $4 trillion industry. I looked up, like the financial sector, the hedge fund sector was a smaller sector than that. So basically the money laundering is larger than personal financial services, the entire sector as a whole. So it's just for everybody out there, which is, what's your response to that, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, money laundering's almost like ETF for crime.
That's actually really good.
And there's going to be, I think people underestimate criminality as an industry, especially when you consider how profitable some of these organizations are, and you're not even dealing with. You're dealing with everything from multi-billion dollar cartels to corrupt politicians who own banks in developing nations to who's that representative in Florida who's getting in hot water, and he would he's in hot water because he Venmo'd
Greenberg or Gates
women, I don't remember, cash, but he would put in the memo for prostitution services.
Yeah.
For reason that boggles my mind. But it's everyone from, you know, that multi-billion dollar organization to that African warlord who's been sanctioned to that girl who's, you know, getting, well, not necessarily that girl, but another girl who's, who hopefully Matt Gaetz has, or whatever that representative is, has learned to pay in cash by now.
Well, exactly. It's, you know, and so if it's such a profitable industry and we spend so much money fighting against the war on drugs and all of this stuff, you know, how much of this $4 trillion do we seize? How much do we get back? It's got to be a lot, right? Nope, less than 1%. And when I say what less than 1%, like, that's not the money that we keep. That's just the money that's forfeited, and then a majority of that is just frozen and then eventually gets returned. Because if you have enough money to be seized, you have enough money for lawyers, and generally that money comes back. And we're going to see there's also really almost no enforcement too. So the British Virgin Islands, one of the world's largest premier offshore havens, in 2014, they had one money laundering prosecution case. I actually don't even know if it was a conviction, just prosecution. The country of Angola estimated that they have lost $17 billion over the last 5 years. Now let's get to, you know, we're saying, all right, well, that's, you know, the one side of the world and, you know, blah, blah, blah. What about domestically for us? What about in the U.S. here? The only country that matters when we're talking about greenbacks, right? Well, in 2015, good old USA laundered $300 billion. And that's actually like what we think is a low estimate, because like I said, that is just in terms of like cash that we can connect, and we're going to talk about banking in a little bit, but Joe, I'm sure you can talk about what a pain this is, because especially if, you know, there's different funds use offshore, you know, I don't want to say havens, because it's a necessary vehicle for the investment industry that's done completely legally and, you know, above board, and people pay a lot of money in lawyers to make sure that it's done compliantly. But there's definitely offshore funds that, you know, send money this way. And so if you have, you know, part of your fund in the British Virgin Islands or somewhere else, and you need to send cash to New York, you know, that's probably direct. So, you know, maybe a bad example, but it's not necessarily direct. If you use a small bank, I'm sure you can see that. I'm sure you have, experience with this, that sending money from one place to the other is not necessarily direct velocity transactions. Has that been your experience?
Well, I think it's important to remember. So what is it you have to do to actually open a bank account, get an IRS number or a 10 tax identification number that takes you about 20 minutes and shows up in about 24 hours? And then you just have to have an operating agreement. So it's not difficult to open a bank account. The only thing that's going to get you, so you could there are probably a lot of bank accounts that are just used for money laundering. And the only thing that's going to get you caught is if you're already under investigation or if you trigger a suspicious transaction report. And there are some industries out there that make it very difficult to distinguish whether they're a legitimate business or money laundering front. The irony is laundromats are one of them. But what about ATM machines? What about, you know, I could see why. And to be honest, my gut instinct of why people would use like the Cayman Islands or British Virgin Islands or Isle of Man for money laundering isn't that it's necessarily easier, because it's not. I've filled out bank account forms in both. I think it's actually because they want the same tax incentives as the businessmen are just using it for everyday business.
Well, exactly.
Because, you know, a lot of these organizations are smart enough to say, hey, we're not going to get Caponed. We're going to pay BS taxes so that at least that's never an issue. Now we've eliminated one problem. Now we just have to turn our greenbacks into spendable money. And the truth is, at a very small scale, that's not difficult at all. When you start getting bigger and bigger and bigger, it becomes more difficult. But again, like you've mentioned, you have more resources. So, I mean, Deutsche Bank, I think, and I love Deutsche Bank, and I love most of the people at Deutsche Bank. You guys are awesome, too. They got in trouble for telling suspected cartel members how to fill out the form specifically so that they wouldn't trigger a suspicious transaction report. Probably because, you know, if you have a $1 billion client and you get 50 basis points or anything remedial from their account, the average man is not going to throw that person under the bus for some sense of ancillary justice or real justice.
Well, and that's a good point too. And even taking a step further beyond that too, let's use Deutsche Bank as an example. Let's say Deutsche Bank I don't know if they have a Chinese affiliate, but just for this example, let's say they have a Chinese affiliate and they need to send, what is most likely going to be won or renminbi, depending on where it is, that needs to come to America. A lot of us think that it's a direct, and so when I say like a direct velocity, they think that when Deutsche Bank sends from China to America, it goes across one pipeline and it goes across many. And in fact, a lot of how the banking system is set up is based on U.S. money laundering laws. So like the U.S. government agencies can pull records from any American partner bank. And I can't remember if they can also pull it from a subsidiary in a different country. I believe it's only if it passes through America and is an American bank. I mean, they do everything in America. But so essentially it causes the banking industry to – if you don't send from China straight to America, what you do is you send it in a network of connected banks next to each other. So essentially what ends up happening is it's a long handshake network, and that's part of why it takes so long. But what happens is you break it up into so many parts, and it becomes nearly impossible to prosecute if you can't follow the money trail. And so if you have one bank that's in one country and one bank that's in another country and it's part of that trail, you might be able to track it up till it gets to that other country, but you may not know where it goes after that. And so while crime piggybacks on that, the original system was set up and so that it could be all tax avoidance. And tax avoidance is absolutely money laundering. But I think everybody, and I'm going to make the distinction too between the difference between violent crime, money laundering, and non-violent crime money laundering. So we'll talk a lot more about how banks move money in between. But we're going to come to find out that like a lot of money laundering is weaknesses in the system that can only be covered by massive surveillance that I don't think anybody can get behind. So it's an interesting kind of problem that has to exist. And so in the you know, in the surveillance state that is the U.S., we must catch a lot of that cash, right? Like I said, that in 2015 we estimated $300 billion was laundered through America. So let's look at the Arizona border crossings, because we're going to find a drugs actually are a small piece of this, and especially even smaller in terms of seizures. So in Arizona border crossings, 12.1 million bulk cash was seized in 2011. That year was estimated that the cartel sold $39 billion in narcotics and services. In 2011, that we did not really have mobile pay services, so almost all of that was going to be in cash. So again, through Arizona, we only caught $12.1 million in bulk cash. At a, you know, not all $39 billion went through there, obviously, but a good percent did. But let's look at another state. We're actually here. So that just as an idea of how big that $39 billion is as well, if we were to take an average return of 5% back in 2011, that $39 billion is now worth $1.7 trillion. So we can see how much of a problem cartels could potentially be, you know, depending on how they go. So in 2019, the government spent literally tens of billion dollars on anti-money laundering countermeasures. And the result of all of that, so Joe was talking about, right? You paid $1 million for all of this compliance. So we would hope that you caught something, right? Like you paid a shitload of money. Would you, even from, you know, let's forget like a justice standpoint aside, but just as like, you know, I paid all this money. If somebody's going to try to cheat the system, just fundamentally you want like at least a good chunk of that caught, right, Joe?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for selfish reasons though, because I don't want to get my job to get any harder.
Exactly.
Like I don't want to have to implement new compliance policies. So from a very selfish reason, I hope a good amount of these people get caught by the current mechanisms so that I have to do less paperwork in the future.
Well, and I'll say this a lot because this is going to be a lot. There's going to be a couple parts and we'll get into it. But Joe and I are – I'm going to walk Joe through like a scenario of like them laundering money through a hedge fund just to point out that like – and not necessarily that I'm against AML compliance or anything like that, because, you know, obviously we need some sort of level of it, and it, you know, may need to be reinvented, but we'll talk about that another day. But essentially my point is that it doesn't pay for every business to launder money. Unless that's your job, right? Unless that's what your business model is to launder money, it doesn't really benefit you to either steal money from your clients or use your clients to steal money from other people, unless it's expressly the business model you choose. So I think we're, you know, there's also this very interesting intersection where, you know, we have AML that is really ineffective and it's not necessarily going to the case that less is more, but it also at the same time, less doesn't incentivize more, which I think is a very interesting inverse efficiency. Because, you know, Joe, if you had no, you know, controls over you or whatever, no reporting, you know, I think you probably would agree that it would be hard to steal money from your clients just from their, you know, how they watch their money. You know, does that gel with you?
95% of the time, right? I mean, you go back to the pre-Madoff era, and I think you'll find most asset managers pre-Madoff were legitimate. And then you go to the Madoff era, and then he screwed it up for everyone because he took advantage of the open architecture of the system to run a very, very large Ponzi scheme. Oddly enough, that's still, you could still do that theoretically. I think you would have to be a illiquid hedge fund, meaning you'd have to be kind of a hybrid hedge fund, and you'd have to say your investments are in very esoteric places. I can give you two examples. One was Brenda Smith of Clearview Investing, who told her clients, I believe, that she was buying the majority of a bond that hadn't yet been created. So obviously, how do you do diligence on where your money is going to go, if it's going to go to a bond that hasn't been yet created. That was one of her angles. Her other angle was that she was going to trade a new instrument, which were binary options, which should have set off alarm bells, but didn't. And people gave her money. And because you didn't know where it's supposed to go at the end of the day, they were able to, you know, some of them weren't laundering money. Some of them just had bad returns and were trying to cover it up. But because you didn't know where the money was going at the end of the day, you could, in theory, you know, steal your client's money. The reason I say it has to be a hybrid or an illiquid hedge fund, because a liquid hedge fund, you know, you have several things in place. You have a prime broker in place who knows where all the positions are. You now have this new SMA fad, which means separately managed account, meaning that, you know, if I go to a traditional asset manager, I can probably say, hey, you know, I like your fund, but I want more transparency. So I'm going to put my money in an account. You're going to manage it, put it into different assets. But at the end of the day, I'm going to be able to see what you're doing with it. So you have a prime broker, you have a new mechanism, you have a fund administrator who knows where the money is going to, is accounting for it and generating reports on it. You have a auditor who's – so if you're in liquid instruments, someone's going to figure out you didn't buy 5 million shares of Apple with that money. Hybrid hedge funds become a little bit easier, but you know, to do more illicit things, or you have to go to other countries that don't have this infrastructure in place. And that's oddly enough, that's not the Cayman Islands. That's not the BVI. That's like China, a lot of Southeast Asia countries. They have a very different approach to due diligence. But to answer the second part of your question, without the current organization of how money ebbs and flows and needing to get a subscription document and hire someone to do AML and KYC and every letter imaginable, E-R-I-O-S-U, you know, It'd be, depending on how large your fund is, it could be either very, very easy to detect if someone's investing with illicit funds, or it could be very, very difficult to predict. And it's kind of like hacking. If someone wants to do it, they'll find a way. I mean, say you're in Colombia or Peru or Chile or Nicaragua, you make your money illicitly. Okay, well, now you go to a bank, open an account for a holdings company. You go to another bank, open an account for a company that owns that holdings company. Like, at what point is the manager supposed to go through all 20 companies to find the source of your net worth or your net wealth or whatever you're investing? So in theory, it's doable from a lot of angles through funds or to invest in funds with illicit money, which I'm sure happens and probably needs to happen. You know, these guys need to make it spendable money that they can invest. But I don't think if you're just trying to get from A to B, A, having cash that you need to make spendable digital dollars, I don't think hedge funds, venture capital funds are going to be your most streamlined source for that.
You are 100% on the nose. I was really hoping you'd say that. So that worked out. That worked out really well. So we're gonna come back to that when we talk about like the whole Aladar network. Because there's a very interesting thing that happens. And so I'm gonna touch on a theme now. I'm not gonna go in depth. I'm gonna let everybody kind of chew on it for a little bit. And so the theme so far, and I don't know if you've picked on it, Joe. I think you have. The money we're talking about is all tied to one source. So it's all by what I mean by that is somebody with a driver's license opened a bank account somewhere and money went into that account, and then money can be traced back to that account should you have access to it. So that means that we have not talked about what happens when you're not attached to that bank account. We'll get to that, but we're still going to go through a little couple more stats first, because we want to – it's been doom and gloom as to why it's been hard to launder money. Let's talk about why it's easy. You know what I mean? We just talked about it being a $4 trillion industry, and it can't all be because the fees are so high, and that's actually really true. So you want to go sling at some crack. You want to go sell some weed. You want to go live the life. When your chance of getting caught is like 26% if you are selling illicit narcotics. So what if you're laundering the money for that? Because, you know, if you're making real money, you're going to want to buy a house. You're going to want to buy some cars. You're going to want to invest. And you just can't do that with big piles of cash in the same way that you could 30 years ago. So if you are the guy who launders the money, right, what's the chance you get caught? Well, in 2020, the FBI brought 66,000 cases to court. So like I said, 26% of those were for drugs. Not exactly 26%. It was 26% chance you'd get caught. But how much of that was fraud, theft, were economic offenses? So of that 66,000, 6,000 of them were economic offenses. So what does the FBI classify as an economic offense? Right. So it's got a couple addition, but the most of the right. So of that 6,005, 4,800 were fraud, theft, and property destruction. The 1,100 remaining were all the other offenses, right? So that means 1,100 of 66,000 cases were money laundering. And that's like as a whole. Now let's talk about if you're an LLC being prosecuted, right? Of those, only 1.3% of them were sole proprietor LLCs. And that's not just 1% chance. That's 1% of that 1,100. So it's like a tenth of a chance that you get caught if you're laundering money through an LLC. Now, this does not include the IRS, right? Part of this is what we talked about earlier. People are paying their taxes. They're staying off the radar. They're doing what they need to do, whatever. So the baseline here is that there is no line on the balance sheet for money laundering. So it's not something you can just look at and spot. It's something that you have. It's a pattern. It's either an outlier to a pattern that is caught, or it's, you know, an illegal transfer of money. It is something like that. So, who deals with this on an enforcement level? So, on a global scale, we have the Financial Action Task Force. So they have kind of set the standards for AML, and they have a top 40 rule list that, if like followed worldwide, would be like the ideal compliance. When we go back in history a little bit, we can look at we think that the term money laundering came about in the 20s or 30s by the gangsters of yore, when they took illicit cash and mixed it with legitimate business proceeds of cash-intensive businesses, like you had mentioned, laundromats. We know that Pablo Escobar ran the most profitable cab company in Colombia's history, and it only had like three cabs or whatever. So there, like, that is stuff where we can look at a balance sheet and say, hey, there's money laundering. But if you get more complicated, you get more complex, it becomes very, very hard to find and combat. And like you said, there are vehicles that are extremely effective for doing it. We didn't really attack, you know, much of, you know, Al Capone went to jail. We had RICO. We had all of that. But it wasn't really catching a whole lot. And so by the 70s and 80s, it was a political problem that we had an influx of narcotics into the U.S. And so Nixon needed to do something about it. And so they had tried the drug, you know, the war on drugs was starting, but they needed to do something on the money side of it. So ironically, he was a big supporter of what would become the Bank Secrecy Act, or the BSA, with Joe, I'm sure you have run into before. And this kind of laid the groundwork for massive financial data gathering operations that we have today. You mentioned suspicious activity reports. So when we look at the example of BSA records, so BSA record, right? You go to a bank, you give them a bunch of cash, something happens. These are all of what happens. So there's the currency transaction report. So deposits or withdrawals over $10,000. It was changed from the CTR FinCEN CTR form. It was changed to the FinCEN CTR form 112 for anyone. I'll give you the actual form numbers. So if people want to look them up online and see what you actually fill out. But a whole – you don't do – not a lot of people do CTR forms. But there's approximately 150 data fields that are on the CTR form that's gathered. The CTR represents the largest volume of BSA data filed, and approximately 14 million – so I apologize. It is filed a lot. 14 million CTRs are filed with the Treasury every year. Joe, did you ever file a CTR? Do you guys have to file CTRs at all?
I've personally had to file a CTR because anytime you take more than like 9,999 out of a bank, one gets filed. And that can, if you do that regularly, that can turn into a suspicious transaction report. They're also filed by the banks anytime you wire or write a check for anything over $3,000. So it expands digitally, and the digital transfer actually is less burdensome, at least from the government's perspective, because you only have to do 3,000 to trigger it, whereas with cash you have to do 10,000 to trigger it. The most I can say about them from my personal experience is if you're trying to do legitimate things, they become quite annoying.
Yeah. Well, and again, right, this every time, and there's a lot of services out there that'll do all this stuff for you, and they will charge you a pretty penny for it. So the next instrument we'll talk about, the Currency and Monetary Instrument Report, or the CMIR. This captures anyone who is leaving or entering the country with currency worth an amount over $10,000. Today, it is known as FinCEN Form 105, and we file hundreds of thousands of them every year. When we look at how many data points the CMIR captures, it's around 70. So the report of foreign bank and financial accounts, or the FBAR. Citizens and resident aliens must file a report with the IRS for any financial interests or signature authority over a foreign bank account, brokerage account, or other types of foreign accounts that exceed certain thresholds known as Form 90-22-1. Or it is known today as FinCEN Form 114. We actually just had somebody that I consult with. They own property in Mexico, got sold, the cash was held in a trust, and they actually just had to go through all this and paid a lawyer. Not too much, but they did end up paying a lawyer to do it, handle all of it for them and take care of finding the lawyer on the Mexican side of things and handling it all there, because you have to report on both sides. So it is amazing. So, and this is a form I'm familiar with, Form 8300, being in cannabis. We take this a lot. Ironically, we don't do CTRs because we don't have access to banking. So there is, when we talk about right gray areas, so the federal government collects their money on the 280E taxation through cannabis. So it says you can only deduct tax, cost of goods for anything that is the sale of illicit drugs on the federal level, so which cannabis still is. So it's interesting. So that stops a lot of – there's essentially no banking. There's a little bit, but essentially no banking. And so it requires access to creative markets. So it's very interesting. So we'll talk about access to loans and things like that. So again, that's what I talk about. Like, the money is attached to one license. So Form 8300, if your business takes in over $10,000 in cash, I've dealt with this for my CBD business too. We've had to do this. It's very interesting going from industries that are not cash heavy to industries that are cash heavy, you know, because in cannabis, we'll regularly see, you know, a courier show up with $80,000, $90,000 in horrible cash. It looks like it came straight from the crack house, and it comes from big companies that are making $100 million a year. But it is very interesting because, you know, prior to working in cannabis, I did not have experience with cash heavy industries, and certainly not on that level. So yeah, so Form 8300, file it, because otherwise, you know, very low chance you're going to get investigated if you keep all your ducks in a row. Which brings us to the suspicious activity report, which you touched on earlier, Joe. This form was implemented in 1996 and modeled after an existing European system that states any financial institution, money service business, and designated non-financial business and professions are required to file SARs. Roughly 2.3 million of these are filed every year. Categories of SAR include money laundering, counterfeit financial instruments, false statements, mortgage loan fraud, identity theft, check fraud, counterfeit currency, and more. So all of this is managed today by Treasury's FinCEN Department Financial. I actually don't remember what this FinCEN, what the CEN part stands for. So we're going to skip that and pretend I don't know what it is. But yeah, so we're all.
Yeah, it sounds more like an Irish political party than it does a U.S. banking task force.
Well, and, you know, it comes back to reading, you know, this thing read, you know, the textbook that this all that I all got this, you know, from was written by the law enforcement. So it's all done. So the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. So I did know that and then ended up forgetting on the radio. So, you know, nice. Everybody got to see that. So we'll all enjoy that when we're famous. The U.S. became the first country to make money laundering a crime. And this was in 1986. And it was Title 18 U.S. Code Section 1956, aka the Money Laundering and Control Act. It did things like criminalizing structuring, which is organizing deposits and withdrawals to avoid detection and reporting. So remember, we talked about that $3,000 check and the $10,000 cash. This would be, you know, setting up deposits so that you didn't run into those. And then it would also add an extraterritorial reach for transactions that happen between partner World Bank and any financial U.S. institution, right? So that's when we talked about, like, if you're, you know, American bank sends money abroad, it, you know, there's a good chance that a broad bank could give access to American authorities because the money started from an American bank. Other notable anti-money laundering laws include the Anti-Drug Abuse Act in 1988, the Annuzio Wiley Anti-Money Laundering Act of 1992, the Money Laundering Suppression Act of 1994, and the Money Laundering Financial Crime Strategy Act of 1998. And they're all as gripping as they sound, and clearly they have been super effective. However, ironically, we're going to jump forward in time a little bit. Joe, what do you think the largest impact on like money laundering was? What act was the biggest impact on that?
Yeah, so I think the first Money Laundering Act had the biggest impact because it kind of opened the floodgates for them to pursue organized crime from a different angle, which is, I think, what the actual intention was. I don't think they cared about the dollars missing from the general economy, you know, that were stuck under some dude's mattress so he couldn't stimulate the economy. Obviously, you can map out that they've become less and less effective because it's gone up and up and up. And we've pretty much, I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on this later, but we've already opened Pandora's box. You know, we've gone... People would have thought that the digital era, you know, I don't think I've come across actual U.S. cash in like a year. So people thought it would disappear with the digital age, but it turned out the opposite was true.
When you're close. So the law that actually had the biggest effect was the Patriot Act. So it actually, because of the expansions of the – to combat terrorist, you know, quote-unquote terrorist funding, it actually increased monitoring and reporting requirements such as check cashers, currency exchanges, registered broker dealers, precious metal and gem dealers, and even more, right? So it went from just those couple to everything. So you're right that the framework of the first anti-money laundering and RICO and all of that opened the floodgates. But yeah, so old George Bush actually expanded it to everything. And that's where when I talk about, you know, I mentioned earlier that we'll talk about money not attached to a bank account, right? Gold is a really good example of that. What is to stop you from giving somebody a briefcase full of gold to go to a gold dealer and getting a pile of cash and bringing it back to you, right? At no point are you attached to that cash, you know, and it is built on, you know, and they say it's the, you know, business is built on trust. We're going to find out that money laundering at its core actually requires trust above all else. There is mutually assured destruction that can happen. But with the way that it's evolved, and it evolved very parallel to business in terms of invoicing and delayed payments and things like that, the natural way that it has to work is through trust. So ironically, something that is rooted in criminality can only work on the basis of trust. So we're going to talk about the three you know, let's get into money laundering already. So that's enough history for everybody that hates history. We're done with that lesson. We're going to get into actual mechanics now. So the three primary methods of money laundering are through financial institutions, right? That's number one. Number two is bulk cash smuggling. Number three is trade-based money laundering. So you might be asking, why is number one, why are financial institutions the number one? And it all comes back to, Joe, you have mentioned this word before, liquidity, right? And so when we talk about liquidity, we talk about digital, you know, it's what started out as physical dollars. How many physical dollars did you have to spend, right? If you're worth $3 million, does that mean that you own a building that's worth $3 million and it would take you 18 months to get that money? Or does that mean you have $18 million stuff somewhere under a mattress, you know, that you can go and spend right away? So as banks and things, you know, became real and trusted and a part of our daily life for all businesses, the same thing became true. It became a matter of liquidity. Is that money put in a financial institution? Can you send it somewhere? Can you receive it? Can you buy something with it? Or is it something that's illiquid, right? So when we talk about cash, in this day and age, cash is, you know, it's technically liquid, right? Is nothing more liquid than cash in theory. In reality, it's extremely liquid, right? We talked about crypto, you know, unless you live next to a Bitcoin ATM, and we'll talk about why even that is not a good form of money laundering anymore. But you can't take cash and even turn it into, let's just say, like a Walmart pay card, or something like that. Let's not even talk about crypto. You can't even turn it in, you know, you can't physically send cash to, you know, if you have family in Pakistan, you know, how do you send them cash from your job, right? You can't put it in an envelope and mail it because you can't trust the mail beyond a certain extent or whatever. It's illegal or, you know, a million different things. So that's why financial institutions are number one, because they take cash, which, you know, I think you could make a pretty good argument is now an illiquid asset, and they turn it into a liquid digital asset, essentially a stable dollar, which I am stealing from crypto. So, right. So, and then that's why we come to cash-based smuggling is number two, because it is liquid, but it is still, it's very close to being liquid. It is like water, right? It's in a super phase. The placement stage is where bulk cash is placed into financial institutions. We talked earlier about if you wanted to avoid a suspicious activity report, if you have $1 million you need to place in, let's say you use a national branch, right? We talked about these big banks. How would you actually launder money through a big bank? So the number one way that they did it in the movies, and we'll talk about it here, right, is what they would do is they would what's called smurfing, right? You take that $1 million and you break it up to $9,000 increments. And if you use a national branch, there might be 100 locations in the state. So you might take 3 days and go to bunch of different locations. They don't talk to each other. And because you didn't trigger an SAR, how's anybody going to know? So by the time anybody, you know, the IRS figures it out based on your taxes or, you know, however they find it, that money's long gone, right? So that is the placement stage. You need to take that a liquid asset, gold, money, whatever it is, and you got to turn it into liquid ones and zeros that you can send across the earth. So let's go back in history just a little bit. Joe, you talked about how they always get around it. So, and that has happened from the beginning of time. So in the 1970s and 80s, money launderers knew that repeated large deposits into South Florida institutions did not trigger government inquiries. So that's where they would go. They would go down to Florida, and that's where they would do their deposits. So when Operation Greenback impeded that, smurfing was born, right? We just talked about smurfing. Going underneath that $10,000 deposit, when that became a hassle, they simply exported the cash to more friendly banking jurisdictions, right? So we can see how each time we added in regulation, we ended up changing it in a way we had no idea. And it turns out that, you know, the return on money laundering, I think a lot, this is a big part of the issue, is that it is so profitable just by its, you know, its existence. The ROI on it is so high that it's going to be almost impossible to price it out of the market because it's a completely elastic demand. Whatever it is that you're smuggling cash through, you pass that cost on directly to your customer, and most likely it's something that they will absorb the price shock to. So it'll be interesting to see as it becomes more and more expensive to do compliance and to actually money launder that money, what ends up happening. So today, AML CFT compliance is estimated to cost $31.5 billion in the US and Canada alone. So, and you know, that means that the banks, and that all comes back to fees that you, me, and Joe pays, right? So it's every, you know, we may not think of hedge funds as small institutions, but they are, especially in comparison to large trader and investment banks. We will talk about that as we go on. I don't know why my microphone symbol. Can you? There we go. Can you hear me? Okay, cool.
Yep.
I'll check it, make sure we were still recording, but we should still be good. And then, so yeah, so it costs a lot of money, and that gets directly transferred to you and me. That's why you got to pay fees into your bank account every month. That's why you got to do all of that shit. And we find, like, again, it was really not effective. So in a lot of businesses, you know, if they can increase the price on something and convince, you know, the government that it needs to have it, you and I and institutions are going to pay the price for it. And like I was saying, you know, we may not think of most hedge funds as small in business, but they are, especially compared to big banks, you know, investment banks that can, you know, they're the size of nations. So, you know, they direct, you know, Joe can speak from experience interacting essentially really close to the most powerful financial institutions on the planet Earth, how little you are in comparison to them, and how if they want to do something, they can do it. So if they want to launder money, they can do it, and they can make sure they make money on it, and they make sure nobody goes to jail. So we know that nobody goes to jail. We know we don't get a lot of money because 2009, we only captured $16 million in AML compliance fines. We talked about HSBC paid a $1.92 billion fine for allowing money to be laundered through their institution. They laundered $900 billion. So literally less than the cost of that. If you paid Square to transfer that money, it would be a smaller percentage than what Square would take of that money. So just to put that in comparison for how big that is. So to combat this, we went the other direction. We created data overflow. Nearly 19 million forms are filed with FinCEN every year, while 2 million of them are the suspicious activity reports. However, there are only roughly 20 analysts that interact with the SARs every day, right? So that means of the 2 million we file, they have to go through 500 reports every day just to get through the SARs alone, and it's not possible. So, and again, because there is no line item for money laundering on a balance sheet. So that kind of brings us to the end of our first. We kind of touched on a little bit of everything. But yeah, so that is how you launder money traditionally, right? And when I say traditionally, again, it's always going to come back to a license and a bank account. But we kind of forget that money has existed for a long time. And for a long time, we've done business across the globe. So at some point, we figured out how to do this. And we figured out how to do it without ripping everybody off. And so, again, it comes back to trust, but it also comes back to very interesting ways that we move money that we don't think of that work today. So to give you an example, if you watched it, Joe, have you seen the movie Rush, Rush Delivery with Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
I can't say that I've had the
pleasure. It's a bike messenger movie, and he's getting chased by a dirty cop. And essentially the premise is there's this Chinese woman who's sending money back to China, and she uses what is called Fei Chen, or flying money. And she gets a ticket that's worth – you know, she gives a broker $50,000, and she gets a ticket, and the cop tries to steal that ticket. But that's where, again, we talk about trust. You know, if – you know, today we send money via ones and zeros, but we don't have to, right? So if I can give you a token and you can bring that token across the world and somebody deposits cash, right, that creates a whole different issue because there's no trail to that other than that token. And so we will find that money launderers are very clever that, you know, operate outside of traditional money lines. So let's say that you have family home in, you know, Afghanistan or wherever, somewhere that you can't just send cash, or let's say it's too expensive. Let's say you don't make enough. Let's say you're an immigrant that cleans houses and you're not making enough to, you know, pay fees, which can be 30-40%. So what do? You use an informal money network. And so you might give your broker $100 and they are going to call somebody in Afghanistan and say, hey, they gave me $100 minus my fee. And then they're going to take that, they're going to allow that family to pick up that $100. Because there may not be a bank there, you know, there may not be, you know, stable financial institutions. So now you've just sent money across the phone with globe with a phone call, and you haven't actually transferred anything. And these guys settle up accounts outside of the transaction. So all of a sudden, right away, we've gone to something that is like 5 or 6 lines of transaction, you know, to send money across the globe that you would have to put together as a prosecutor. So things get really complicated really quick. So we're going to go over them in the next episodes, but we wanted to get something out to you guys so that you can start listening. Joe, you got any closing thoughts for us?
No, I'm excited to dive in and especially talk about the more modern aspects. And I think if you enjoyed this episode, you'll for sure enjoy those episodes.
Thank you guys for joining. The next one is going to be a little bit more example based. We kind of went over a lot of the basics today. This is kind of like syllabus week, so I apologize. We got all of the nitty gritty out of the way. But yeah, so it's a lot of money. It's a big $4 trillion. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money, and it's not all just guns and drugs and shoot 'em up. So a lot of it is guys in suits moving money around in very creative ways and ways that were done a long time ago that still work. So we have yet to combat 1,000-year-old money networks. So we're going to touch on all that. But again, guys, this is a Brave New World podcast. I'm your host, Max Lupo. I'm here with Joe St. Feltri. We are signing off. We will be back soon. Joe, thank you for being with me tonight, my friend. You got any closing remarks? If not, we're going to take off.
Thanks for having me as always, and looking forward to it.
All right, my friends, you guys be safe and you enjoy, and the next episode will be up soon.